The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hey folks, this episode of the History of Literature podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Go to audibletrial.com/HOL for a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial. Audible has more than 180,000 titles, including many of the books we've covered here on the show. That's audibletrial.com/HOL for a special free offer for listeners of the History of Literature podcast. Now, let's get on with the show. Okay, hello. We have a very special show today. Welcome, first of all, to our new sponsor, Audible.com. What a great synergistic sponsor that is for this podcast. We will have some specific recommendations after today's show. Audiobooks, books we've discussed, read by actors and celebrities and voice artists and sometimes the authors themselves. Handpicked by me, Jack Wilson, the host of the show. Several of you have told me that you're all caught up with the show and you wish I came out with the episodes a little more quickly. A little passive-aggressive comment. A little more quickly, Jack. I could use a few more. Well, in the meantime, why not fill the gap with some audiobooks? Maybe catch up on a few recommended by Vu Tran, like Edith Wharton's House of Mirth and Age of Innocence, many others by Ms. Wharton, or Go with the Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. And what else did Vu recommend? Oh, yes, The Magus by John Fowles. They have that there at audible.com. That'll get your money's worth. Or Lydia Davis, one of Mike's favorites. You can get her collected stories or listen to her translation of Madame Bovary. Man, I think we need to have Ms. Davis on the show. Anyway, a lot of good choices over there at audibletrial.com/HOL. Okay, today is a great episode. I've said that before. This one truly is. Charles Baxter, our guest, is the author of numerous novels, collections of short stories, and essays. His criticism is routinely found in the New York Review of Books. And what else is there to say? He's the author of Feast of Love, Burning Down the House, The Soul Thief, Believers, Shadow Play, many other great books. He's all over anthologies. He is truly an American treasure. And I don't throw that around lightly. Well, don't just take my word for it. Here's the Nobel Prize winner herself, Alice Munro. Quote, "I hardly ever do this sort of thing." Oh, I'll stop there. She was talking about endorsing a book. Quote, "I hardly ever do this sort of thing, but Charles Baxter's stories have reminded me of how broad and deep and shining a story can be, and I am grateful." End quote. Wow. Wow. Could there be a better endorsement? I got a nice tweet once from Harry Shearer, which was wonderful. Kind of made my month, if not my year. Those of you who followed along with the blog probably remember that, how excited I was that Harry Shearer, the voice of Mr. Burns and Smithers and so many other Simpsons characters, along with Spinal Tap and all the many things Harry Shearer has done, sent me a nice tweet. I was excited for months. But Alice Munro, a fan of your work? Imagine what that would be like. A fan of your stories? Wow. Sounds like she was almost compelled to offer her gratitude. That is a serious accomplishment. Anyway, Charles Baxter, the recipient of that compliment, is here today as our guest to discuss his life as a reader. Because in addition to being a wonderful writer of novels and short stories, he's also one of the most thoughtful readers of literature that you'll ever find. I asked him to choose some books that he has loved during his career as an author and a professor and just generally a sensitive human being. His career as a sensitive human being. Can you have a career as a sensitive human being? I suppose I should polish up my resume, just in case you can. His life as a sensitive human being, that's better. Anyway, we'll be discussing his choices, why he loves these books, and how they influenced him in just a moment. But first, Let me remind you to please subscribe to the show wherever you download your podcasts, rank us and review us, and leave us feedback on Facebook or at historyofliterature.com or by sending me an email at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, wilsonauthor@gmail.com. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's get on with the conversation with our guest, the great, great Charles Baxter. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off.
How old were you when you decided you wanted to be a writer? And did that decision change how you read fiction, for example?
I must have been a teenager when the idea, which even then seemed preposterous to me, of becoming a writer occurred to me. Nobody I knew was a writer. I had never met a writer. I had heard about writers, and I knew that my parents had known a few of them. And when I was in high school, I have a dim memory of meeting an American novelist, actually a Minnesota novelist named Fred Manfred, who had written a book called Lord Grizzly. It was a bit of a hit in its day. But the idea of being a writer seemed so preposterous that it didn't occur to me that you could do it, that you could actually make a living doing it. But once I got to college, I knew, or I made the acquaintance of at least a couple of faculty members who were also novelists or poets, and I thought, oh, well, maybe it is possible if I also learn how to be a teacher. So that was the route I took. But it really, I mean, my passion for reading started when I was about 16. Mm. 16 or 17, I think.
Did it start with poetry, or was it all kinds of, was it wide-ranging?
Oh, no, it was fiction. Mm. It was fiction and movies.
Mm.
I have to keep reminding people that when I was a teenager, if you went into a drugstore, there were usually paperbacks for sale, 50 cents, a dollar, $1.50, and they were, I mean, you could find classics in these paperback racks, but also pretty good middle brow fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I read all of this stuff. I always set aside a time in the evening just before I had to go to bed after I finished my homework when I would read one or another novel that I had found in the drugstore. And I, you know, eventually, you know, it occurred to me, I would love to do that.
Right.
I would love to be the person who casts a spell over other people the way these books have cast a spell over me. You know, I guess I just held on to that idea for dear life.
Right. I asked you to choose some books that you've loved.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave me a pretty long list. And I suspect that you were even with the length of the list, I suspect you were just scratching the surface. And I feel like you've loved a lot of books in your time. Is that fair?
I have. It's actually a problem because every time somebody like me moves, you know, you have all of these books and you have to box them up and you've got to alphabetize them and you've got to put them someplace. And if you can't do that, you can't find them. But yes, there are a lot of them.
And are you still able to fall in love with a book? Do you find yourself looking back to old favorites, or can something new that comes your way still trigger the same feeling?
You know, that's a really good question. And I have to say that it's much, much harder for me to fall in love with a book, to fall in love with a piece of music, to fall in love with a painting. It's harder as you get older to fall in love, period.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. But I'm still optimistic. I like to think that I can read a book and be surprised and kind of delighted by it. It still happens. It happens now and then.
You know, the other thing that I think happens, and I'm seeing this as I'm kind of in the middle of the journey here, is I will take pleasure in something that I'm rereading just because it was a part of my past.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I can remember being about 20, I think I was 22 or 23, and it was kind of odd. I was on a JAG reading Henry James, of all people, and I can remember exactly where in the summer I read The Portrait of a Lady. And, you know, that's a pretty good age to read that book, because that book, among other things, is about making a catastrophic choice about who you're going to love and settle down with. And, you know, when you're 22, 23, that's a very serious...
That's big on your mind.
It's very much on your mind. And that book has all kinds of resonance for, or it did for me at that age. And, you know, so did the novels of D.H. Lawrence, people like that.
Okay, so let's talk about our first author. I basically selected a handful from your list, and the first one that I wanted to talk to you about is James Wright, who was a poet born in 1927, and he lived until 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned them as poems that have held up for you.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what do you find there?
Okay, so I have to tell a story first.
Okay.
I was, I think, a junior in high school, and my brother, Lou, came home from McAllister College. I think he was home for Thanksgiving or Christmas, and I asked him what classes he was taking, and he said that he was taking a course in Russian literature in translation. They were reading the stories of Chekhov, and this course was being taught by a guy named James Wright. And he said that James Wright was also a poet, and my brother had bought one of James Wright's books, and he showed it to me, and the book was called The Branch Will Not Break.
Mm-hmm.
And he left the room, and I opened this book, and I thought, oh, Wesleyan University Press, that can't be serious. Just a university press, what kind of book is this?
Right.
And I opened it up, and I had that experience that you have, I don't know. If you're lucky, you have it many times in a lifetime. But the experience I had was reading the first few poems and thinking, oh, I get it. That's what poetry is. Oh, you know, nobody had to tell me that these poems were actually poems. You know, the Quakers have this phrase that something speaks to your condition.
Mm.
And I read these poems, and, you know, they're lyrically desolate and beautiful. And they also have as their background a kind of Midwestern landscape.
Right.
He was living in Minnesota at the time, and he was from Ohio. He was from an industrial town in Ohio. And the poems just instantly spoke to me, and I had the good luck of turning to a poem that's probably one of his most famous ones, Lying in a Hammock in William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. And I got to the last line of that poem, which is, I've wasted my life.
Yes.
You know, I was just a junior in high school, but I thought I knew what he meant, and I thought I knew what it was like to feel that, you know, a lot of your time has been wasted. And it was just as if my eyes were opened. And after that, I was an avid reader of his work. I read St. Judas and Shall We Gather at the River and all of the books as they came out. They made a great difference to me in my life. It was the first time I had read poetry and just had an instinctive sense of what it was all about.
It seems like you maybe had some affinity for the setting and the location, but also just the state of mind and the presence.
Absolutely, yeah. The settings he was talking about were settings that I knew. In Shall We Gather at the River, there's a poem called the Minneapolis Poem. It's the greatest poem ever written about Minneapolis, and unfortunately for the city, it's a curse. Mm-hmm. It's a curse on the city. He hated Minneapolis. But it didn't matter to me. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was recognizing something about these locales and these sorts of people I knew and finding them in those poems. I had the good luck to meet him, and I was once at a reading that he gave in Brockport. He was giving this reading, and he read a poem by Apollinaire he had recently translated, La Jolie Russe. It's translated as The Pretty Redhead.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to a line in that poem. I hope I don't bungle it. It's all we want is kindness, enormous country where everything is silent. And he stopped and he looked at the audience and he said, and he was completely serious about this, he said, I would sell my soul to have written that line. And nobody laughed. Nobody laughed. They all knew he meant it. In the early 70s, with the New York School and a lot of a lot of poets writing kind of surrealistic and jokey, comical poems, to find somebody who was as serious about poetry as he was. Anyway, I loved it, and those poems meant a lot to me.
You know, it's funny because I had actually typed out Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota as the poem I wanted. I was going to read it and then ask you questions about it. It is such a beautiful poem. It reminds me of haiku in a way. It's sort of the way that it goes through the setting,
yeah,
and then the way that the speaker kind of surprises you with,
yeah,
his own sentiment toward the end.
Right, right. You know, the poem begins as a kind of almost, I won't say Wordsworthian, but it begins as a nature poem. I mean, the poet is in repose, and he's looking up at the trees, and he's looking into the sky, and he sees a bird, and he's looking down at the ground and sees that. And you think, oh, I know where we are. I know what kind of poem this is. And then like a haiku, it makes a swerve.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a swerve that is really breathtaking. I can't remember the line that immediately precedes, "I have wasted my life," but I think it's a hawk that's circling.
It's a chicken hawk floats over looking for home.
Looking for home. I have wasted my life.
Ugh.
I sat there just stunned. And in those days, I hadn't read Rilke. I hadn't read poems like the Archaic Torso of Apollo, which has...
You must change your life.
Right. There is no place that does not see you. You must change your life. Boom. You know, sudden swerve that if you're alert, if you're alive to the poem, you can't breathe when you see that.
Right.
It was, for me, it was almost like being punched in the stomach in a spiritual way, in a good way. You know, there are other poems of his that are like that. There's a poem of his on President Harding, and you'd think, my God, how could you possibly write a poem about, you know, one of the worst presidents of the United States? But, you know, the second half of that poem is about his tomb in Marion, Ohio, and the last lines they're just astounding. I could recite them, but I won't. It's too pretentioso, but, you know, he had the ability of making these giant statements at the ends of his poems that, as people say in workshops, seem to have been earned.
I was just going to say, he earns his way there.
He earns his way there. You think, how on earth did you get there? And then you look at the poem and you think of where it's going and how it's traveling and doing its work, and you think, now I see.
Mm-hmm.
Now I get it.
And when I read this, the Lying in a Hammock poem, I immediately knew that this would have appealed to me at any age. I think after the age of about 16, it wasn't something that only someone in their 40s or 50s could identify with, or you have to be at the end of your life as he was, or that you have to be, you know, 20 and looking forward. It's just feels like if you have the right sensibility, it will hit you.
Yeah. I think teenagers are more sensitive than people usually give them credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And they're often onto the waste of,
right.
I mean, what it means to waste time, what it means to waste a life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look at adults
and
they see it. They know. No, you know, nobody has to lecture them about that. No, they get it. And I just think, you know, I think poems like that are wonderful for young people. Anyway, that was when I first got hit between the eyes by those poems.
I also love the line in there, "I lean back as the evening darkens. And comes on."
Yeah.
And
isn't
I thought
that great?
Editors would cross out "and comes on." Right? They would say, "as the evening darkens." And then I thought, nope, that adds something. That "and comes on" is just beautiful.
Yeah. In fact, I can't help reciting a part of the Harding poem, because it has some things in it that editors would cut. The end of the poem runs something like, "America goes on laughing, laughing, and Harding was a fool. Even his big pretentious stone lays him bare to ridicule. I know it, but don't look at me. I didn't start this mess. Whatever moon and rain may be, the hearts of men are merciless." And those lines, the two greatest lines in it are, "I know it, but don't look at me." He loved, you know, he loved vernacular. He loved the sorts of things that people actually said.
Right.
And you have to be an American and to have grown up when he did to recognize that line, don't look at me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not to blame for this.
Yes.
Don't look at me.
So good. Well, we could do a whole episode on James Wright, but I do want to get to the other some of the other authors here.
Oh, all right.
But before we do, I have a surprise bonus question.
Okay.
So, you awake from a long nap and find an angel sitting at the foot of your bed. She tells you that you've been given the chance to attend a dinner with James Wright. You can go alone or invite another writer as a guest. Any writer, living or dead. Do you take someone else? And if so, who do you choose?
Oh, sure. I would absolutely take someone else. I wouldn't want to be selfish in all of this. And actually, the answer is not that difficult. You know, the first person I thought of was Edith Wharton.
Oh.
Because she'd be good company.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd keep the conversation going.
Yes.
But that's actually not who it's going to be. It's Chekhov.
Oh.
Because the two of them would get along.
Oh my God.
Like a couple of old friends.
Yes.
And you know, they would understand each other perfectly well. I mean, they both came from poor hardscrabble parents. They worked very hard to become writers in a milieu where, you know, not much encouraged them to be writers. They both had other occupations. Chekhov was a doctor, and James Wright was a translator and a teacher. But I think they would also have plenty to say about non-literary matters.
Right.
And, yeah, that's who I'd invite.
Wow. You know, you would probably fit right in with those two, but I could imagine that if I was at the dinner, I could imagine myself just chattering away, trying to impress them or do something, and the two of them just kind of looking at each other knowingly and exchanging a glance.
Well,
they
you know,
seem like they would be fast friends.
I think so. You know, it's an odd thing about meeting writers who are actually wonderful, or I mean, who knows what great is, but I've met a fair number of writers in my lucky life, and quite a few of them are not ones to go nattering on about themselves. In fact, they have a tendency. William Maxwell was like this. You know, you'd try to get Maxwell to talk about himself. He wouldn't do it. He'd just keep asking you about, well, what was your life like? What was your childhood like? What was Minnesota like where you grew up? And you could draw him out of that, but it was hard.
I have a part two for the surprise bonus question.
Oh, uh-huh.
The angel says, unfortunately, Mr. Wright is very busy. You can only ask him one question. What would your question be?
These surprise questions are not very easy. if I had, good God, if I had one question to ask James Wright, it would be, you can see I'm struggling.
Well, here's a way we can get you off the hot seat is,
okay,
tell me what you're struggling with. What would you, is it because you have admiration for him, or because you can't just pick one?
No, it's partly because in 1972, James Wright was teaching at the State University of New York at Buffalo during the summer, and they had given him an office, and I barged in to the office, and I brought some of my poems, and I forced him to read them.
Right.
I guess the question I would ask him is, do you forgive me for doing that? I hope, you know, in whatever Parnassian locale he's in, that he has forgiven me by now.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you're... I think this is because you've had a lot of success in your writing career, that your question for him was not, hey, man, are you going to help me get those poems published or not?
No, it's just, will you forgive me? No, that's all.
Okay, so let's take a look at another one of the authors that you chose, which was, you mentioned the novels of Saul Bellow. Which mm-hmm. I wasn't too surprised that at some point in your life you had fallen in love with the novels of Saul Bellow, but I was a little bit surprised that you discovered them in high school. And I'm wondering, what kind of high schooler were you, and were your friends reading Saul Bellow, or was this something you were doing on your own?
Oh, no. I had the very considerable advantage of being very unhappy in high school. We lived out in the middle of nowhere. We had no neighbors, and I was that walking cliche, the unhappy, lonely teenager. So I became bookish. Mm-hmm. If I were to grow up now, I probably would be on the net, on the web all the time. I don't know what I'd be doing.
Right.
But, you know, when I was a junior, senior, the Bellow novel Herzog came out, and it was being reviewed everywhere, and you know, as the great contemporary American novel. So I went into Minneapolis. I must have had a driver's license. Well, I mean, Minnesota, you could drive by age 15 in those days. And there was a bookstore in downtown Minneapolis called The Bookcase, and they had it. And I went up to the counter. It was the first edition. I still own it. It cost $4.50. And the manager of the store looked at me and said, "I don't know why anybody in the world would want to read that book." So there I was trying to, you know, be brave and, you know, get a foothold in the world of literature, and this guy was saying, "Who do you think you are? What do you think this is?" Anyway, I went home and I started reading it, and at first it didn't make very much sense to me.
Right.
You know, there was this guy Herzog who was writing to somebody named Heidegger. And who was Heidegger, and why was he writing these letters? But gradually I figured out that Herzog was separated from his wife. He was very unhappy. And then I got to the part of the novel where Herzog has been separated from his wife and from his daughter, Junie. And this guy, Valentine Giersbach, who's a kind of vulgarian, and a monster, is the wife's boyfriend.
Right.
And Herzog gets a gun, and he's going to go over to Gersbach's and shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember this scene?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody remembers this scene.
Yeah.
He walks around Gersbach's, I can't remember whether it's an apartment or a house, with his gun, and he's peering in the window like a crazy person, and what he sees is Gersbach bathing his daughter, not Gersbach's daughter, but Herzog's, Junie.
Right, right.
She's in the bathtub, and Gersbach is bathing her tenderly, and it's kind of like that, it's a swerve, like the swerve in the James Wright poem, and what I liked about it was that I didn't, you know, I was coming out from under the thumb of the English teachers I had had, who told me that everything had a symbolic meaning and that literature was a puzzle that you had to solve. And I thought, no, it's not a puzzle that you have to solve. It's these scenes that are all about people who are heartbroken and crazy and are ready to do mayhem and then see something that twists them around. Bellow is kind of doing a riff on a similar scene from the Brothers Karamazov in that passage, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't have to know it. It was better that I didn't know it.
Right, right.
You know, the experience was much more raw for me.
Yeah. I mean, Bellow, he seems to be, first of all, it doesn't surprise me, I guess, hearing what kind of high schooler you were, that he appealed to you, because he's such good company when he's at his best. He's the prose, and it just is so much fun, and it's so electrifying, and the way he creates an entire world, and
And it's funny too.
Yeah,
you know, Henderson the Rain King is exuberant, and it's often hilarious. Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say that he seems to be this really compelling combination of kind of a tough guy, you know, a street tough, but he's also just as sensitive as
right. And he was acquainted with all those different levels of society in Chicago, you know, the intellectuals. You know, he could trade ideas with anybody, but he was also comfortable, I think that's the word, with business people, you know, these rich and powerful guys, like, you know, his brother.
Yeah, his brother's kind of a hustler.
Yeah. And you can tell in when you're reading Bellow's novels that often he can't make up his mind whether it's better to be rich and powerful, you know, a real mocker, a guy who makes a difference in the world of affairs, or whether it's better to be the person who thinks about it and, you know, judges all of that from a distance. That all of that runs through his books right to the end, right to Ravelstein.
Mm. Are you ready for the surprise bonus question?
I guess so. Now I'm worried. But okay, yeah, shoot.
You awake from a long nap.
And it's that angel again.
No, this time you find yourself on a stage.
Uh-huh.
An evil moderator tells you that you are in a debate for your life.
Uh-huh.
Your job will be to persuade the audience that the novels of Saul Bellow are the best possible window into understanding 20th century America. Your opponent, a similarly dazed individual sitting on a, sitting on a chair next to you, will be attempting to do the same, only she has been given John Updike. How do you like your chances?
I think my chances are pretty good.
Mm.
The reason I think my chances are pretty good is that I think there's more... Oddly enough, there's more of the world in Bellow's novels, and I think the thinking is better than it is in Updike. You know, David Foster Wallace wrote an essay. It's kind of a killer essay.
Oh, yeah.
Called
where he took on John Irving and...
well, he really took on Updike.
Updike.
The essay is called Certainly the End of Something or Other One Would Surely Have to Think, and it's a review of Toward the End of Time, and what he says about Updike is that the guy's a narcissist.
Yeah.
He's a male narcissist, and he's mostly thinking about what he's thinking about, and what he's thinking about is women and a few odds and ends of other things. But I would, you know, I would say that although Bellow has a trace of that, you know, his novels take place in Romania.
Mm-hmm.
They take place in a kind of imaginary Africa. They take place in Chicago. They're about so many things, but they're, you know, it seems to me that they're really about power and the degree to which the power that people have messes them up and the very complicated ways that it does so. And then the ways that too much thinking and too much reading messes people up. I'm making him out to be more of a downer than he is. I mean, it's just wonderfully enlightening and I think enlivening and fun. You feel smarter when you're reading Bellow, and I never quite get that feeling when I'm reading Updike.
Right.
I don't think that I'm learning that much.
Right.
Reading his work.
Right. You feel like he's showing you how smart he is.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. Occasionally Bellow gets like that, but most of the time he wants you to
wrestle with the ideas with you, with him.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Okay, here's part two.
Yeah.
A third person is hauled onto the stage. He mm-hmm. has been assigned yet another 20th century American author, but you don't yet know who it is. Is there anyone you're afraid of, or will you stick with Bellow against all comers?
All comers in the 20th century?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No. Okay.
No. No. No.
Do you have any names for us, or you're just taking the field?
I'm just... Here's the thing. Because I'm in the hot seat, I get to say that if Bellow were here, he would smile and he'd tip his hat and he'd say, "What's with all this ranking? What's with the ranking of writers?"
Right.
And I think, you know, it, just for American writers, he'd just start saying, "Well, what about Wright Morris? You haven't read much Wright Morris lately, have you?" And everybody would say no. And Bellow, who loved Wright Morris's work, would say, "Well, it's time that you read him." And then he'd talk about Willa Cather. He'd talk about his friend Ralph Ellison. He'd talk about James Baldwin. And then we'd get to some of the writers, the Russian writers he might have loved, like Bulgakov.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and... Oh, who, you know, all of the others. I, you know, even Bellow wouldn't say that he needs to be given the prize. There are plenty of people. You know, it's a big arena. Lots of people can fit in there.
Now, do you think that he's aging? I'm wondering if he's becoming part of kind of a time capsule. Do you think he's readable? Like his best work, some of them feel to me almost as far away as Henry James or someone does. Do you think people read him anew, afresh, or do you think it's they're time traveling when they read him?
I think something has happened
mm-hmm.
to him. I think he feels dated. Certainly the World War II books.
Mm-hmm.
Dangling Man and The Victim are kind of dated, and there are some of his books like More Die of Heartbreak that I think people just don't read anymore.
Right.
But I think Seize the Day, a book that Bellow didn't like very much, I think that's beautiful. I think anybody can pick that book up and read it and be incredibly moved by it. Mm-hmm. It's a short novel. You can read it almost in one sitting. It's great. And I don't know. I mean, the whole business of literary reputations is tricky. You never know when a writer is going to be picked up and read again. It's interesting to me, you know, now that William Maxwell has been gone for quite a few years now, people seem to be very much still reading So Long, See You Tomorrow. It's a book that I see younger writers and just plain old readers reading all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Humboldt's Gift...
I was going to say, Humboldt's Gift is on my short list of books that I return to all the time.
Yeah, I think that's just one of the best. And Herzog, those two, I love them, and I love the short stories too.
Okay, so speaking of short stories, the next pick that we have is Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a good choice for a writer to make, especially someone who is as good and as well known for writing short stories as you are. And I'm wondering, were you reading him before you turned your hand to short stories, or is this something you fell in love with him after you were already an aspirational writer yourself?
Oh, I never understood Chekhov when I was younger. I looked at the stories and I thought, what is everyone talking about? I just don't get this at all.
Right.
you know, people were running down the street, yelling and screaming about the lady with the dog, and I read it and I thought, what? What is all the noise about? And then what were the stories I read? I think they were the ones in the Norton anthology of Chekhov, A House with a Mansard Roof, and Gusev, and the Bishop, and Rothschild's Fiddle. And I just didn't get any of it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any of it. In my 20s and 30s, I thought it was like this massive scheme that it was a great practical joke that people were trying to play on everyone else, you know. And I read Nabokov on Chekhov, and Nabokov says even in Russian the prose has this gray quality. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. And then when I was in my 40s, I think my late 30s, early 40s, I turned to those stories again, and I think I had the good luck to read Gooseberries, and I looked again at The Lady with the Pet Dog. And what finally did it, though, was a story that often people ignore, they don't talk about, a story called In the Ravine.
Hmm.
And I read that story, and finally, you know, I'm a little slow. Finally, finally I got it.
Right.
Finally I got it. I mean, that story is about environmental degradation. It's about the worst side of free enterprise. It's about greed. Chekhov knew everything there was to know about greed. Greed and cruelty and stupidity and environmental degradation. And I thought, I love this.
Mm.
I don't know if I love this, but I mean, as a work of literary art, I did. And then, you know, that kind of You have to grow up a little for the sense of motiveless, that strange longing that's in Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
The longing. I think the German word for this is Sehnsucht. You know, the longing that has almost no source. You have to grow into that feeling, or to have had some experience before it begins to make sense to you. Anyway, that was it. And then what began to happen was that I read the plays too.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Uncle Vanya, which
right.
is a very important play to me. And then it all began to fall into place. But I had to grow up some, you know.
It's so interesting because we've talked about how teenagers can get things by looking at adults.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you describe this, and I'm going to read to you my questions that I had prepared. And
mm-hmm.
one of my questions was, did you love Chekhov right away or did it take time? And then my next one was, can you return to them now? I find that I can. Unlike a lot of authors, I get more out of them as I age. And it just seems like so much of the literature that I love is stuff that it hit me square between the eyes when I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
And Chekhov just seems like there's something deep about it, or it is something that you need to grow into.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking about these other writers, and even Bello is very excitable, and, you know, some of his fiction comes to you with exclamation points. Chekhov is the guy over in the other side of the room,
mm-hmm.
who's talking quietly, and his stories are not rhetorical. They're told very quietly, as a friend tells another friend a story, maybe late at night. And you have to let your time sense calm down a little bit for that. You have to calm down spiritually. You have to calm down in order to be on that particular wavelength. But once you get it, it kind of sours you for a lot of other fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's been a huge influence. Do you see traces of him at all as you are reading student writing or reading your fellow authors? Or do you think it's just an invisible influence because it's so pervasive?
That's hard to say. I don't see Chekhov's influence that much in the writing of my students. I see it in my own stuff, and I can pinpoint exactly where it is.
Right.
I know where the cadences have come in. But I think it's among my contemporaries, other writers who are approximately at my stage of life. I mean, I think we've all, or most of us, have had that experience of feeling that we're following in his footsteps. I think a lot of people feel this way about Alice Munro, too, that she has shown a lot of us a different way of writing stories and how to do it in a sort of architectural way.
Mm-hmm.
Ways of telling stories in which the most serious stuff is out in the open and yet nobody talks about it.
Right. Okay. Well, we basically steamrolled over the surprise bonus question for that one because we've covered everything I was going to cover in it. So let's take a look at another choice of yours. And I think this is probably the one on the list that people will be least familiar with. Paula Fox.
Right.
The novelist and children's book author. She was born in 1923. And her books have kind of famously gone in and out of print, but they're all worth reading. And at least one of them, Desperate Characters, from 1970, I think is often considered a masterpiece.
Right. And what happened with her was that I think an editor at W.W. Norton, actually I'm not sure exactly how this happened, but there were so many writers of my generation who wanted to see those books back in print that they were reissued by Norton in paperback with introductions. Introductions or afterwards by people like Andrea Barrett and Jonathan Leatham. And I think they're all in print now. The place where people who don't know her work should start is probably Desperate Characters, but The Widow's Children is a kind of wonderful novel too. It's very funny. It's very scary. If you have ever been to a family reunion and people are drinking too much and at least one or two members of the family are really mean and funny mean, you get a sense of what that book is up to. It's really about the Widow's Children is really about adults who for some reason have not quite been able to grow up. I ran across a word for this the other day, kidult. Do you know that word?
No.
The other word for it is rejuvenile. But she's very smart and very moving on social interactions in which people's behavior is simply, you can't predict what people are going to do. And so the characters have to practice a kind of hypervigilance mm-hmm. all the time. She's very good on the way you start to get nervous about your neighborhood and the people who are in it and the people who might cause you trouble, that sort of white paranoia from the 70s. I think she's a kind of minor classic writer, but still classic. She came to the University of Michigan when I was teaching there.
Mm.
And somebody asked her what the hardest problem was that she had to face down as a writer. And she thought about it for a moment, and then she said, self-consciousness.
Mm. Right.
Just thinking of yourself as a writer at the desk and thinking, oh, what am I going to do next? Instead of just trying to let yourself be the medium through which the story flows.
You know, it's interesting that was her answer, because the thing that always struck me when I was reading her books is the feeling I would have that I would be thinking, you know, I am reading a lot of novels and I've read a lot of novels and I am not calling any of the shots here. I'm not predicting anything. Like it's right. constantly surprising me with what it does, and not in a sort of like it's logical and right. it makes sense, but it is continuously surprising me.
It's virtuoso stuff. Anybody who opens up The Widow's Children and there's a scene that takes place in a hotel room where these family members are drinking, and one of the characters has a secret which she's not telling anybody else, and everybody else is getting liquored up, and the scene goes on and on and on. I think it's one of the longest single sustained scenes in American literature. It goes on for almost 70 pages, and you think, nobody can do this.
Mm.
Nobody can do this. I don't know where this is going. How is this possible? And yet it is possible.
Right. Another thing I wrote down was that it's like the long tracking shots, like the ones that open Goodfellas or Touch of Evil or something. It just
right.
it just feels
right.
like so much comes in and out, and you're yeah. still in the same, you're just captive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're in the presence of somebody who knows everything there is to know about how to, you know, as in those movies, how to stage a single scene, a tracking shot, and with Paula Fox, somebody who knows everything there is to know about setting, point of view, dialogue, and the kinds of psychological cards that get played in a meeting of people who haven't seen each other for a long time but know each other maybe too well. It's like that. You're just in the hands of somebody who knows what he or she is doing.
Right. Okay. So this is kind of a surprise bonus question. And I'm setting up our big finale here.
Okay.
Desperate Characters came out in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guess the best-selling book of 1970?
Of 1970? No, I can't. I lose the bonus round.
Okay. I'm going to give you some names and some books of the best-selling books from 1970 and 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And 1970, the number one selling book was Love Story by Eric Segal.
Right, of course.
The French Lieutenant's Woman is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Ernest Hemingway, Islands in the Stream.
Yeah.
And then there's all of these people. Graham Greene is number nine. Mm-hmm. Irwin Shaw. And yeah. then 1971, there's Arthur Haley and The Exorcist and Irving Stone and Harold yeah. Robbins and Frederick yeah. Forsyth and Herman yeah. Wouk, Michener and Updike. And then I took a look at the best-selling books of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
The number one is The Fault in Our Stars, that book by John Green, which is a, mm-hmm. a young adult novel.
Yeah.
Number two is Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Mm-hmm. Which is another kid's book. Number 3, 4, and 6 are Divergent, Insurgent, and Allegiant, young adult novels. Number 5 yeah. is the Bill O'Reilly co-authored Potboiler.
Killing Somebody.
Killing Patton. and then 8 and 9 are actually movie tie-in versions of The Fault in Our Stars.
Yeah.
And number 10 is Frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my theory. If you think about the novels that I mentioned from 1970 and 1971, it is not as big of a jump to someone like Paula Fox. Those were adults.
Right.
You know, those were books for adults, and they might be kind of potboilers, some of them, but they're also training you to read in a certain way and to understand novels and to accept novels in a way that we just don't seem to have a lot of evidence of adults doing that in big numbers. At least in 2014. And it makes me wonder if, you know, it makes it that much harder for someone who is a Paula Fox to find any sort of readership.
It may be. I think certainly something has happened to the mass audience that we once had. But it's hard to know exactly whether it's gone away or whether it's gone somewhere else. It's true that if a kid goes down to the drugstore, he can't pick up a novel by Davis Grubb or J.R. Salamanca. These are kind of forgotten authors, but they're the authors whose works nurtured me when I was a teenager. You can't find that stuff in the drugstore anymore. But Tony Doerr's book, All the Light We Cannot See, has been on the bestseller list for, what, 140 weeks now?
Mm.
2 or 3 years that book has been on the bestseller list. And I'm told that poetry is selling as well or better than it ever has. I mean, we can't kid ourselves. Something has happened to the way we experience art. I just noticed this when I was in New York last week. I used to like it when I was on the subway. You would see people reading.
Right.
You see them reading books. And now they're all looking at their smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's possible that they're reading a book on their phone. I don't know. It's easy to pontificate and to say that there's a lot of infantilization going on thanks to the movies and TV. And there is a lot of infantilization going on, and you can see it in what's happened to political discourse as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that serious poetry and serious novels are still being written, and they still have good audiences. But I think you're right, probably, that bestsellers are not what they were 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They just aren't.
That was kind of my final question. You care about literature as much as anyone I know or anyone I've ever met. You've devoted your life to it. Do you ever feel a concern for literature that is fading in importance, or there are parts of it that are dying out?
Well, what I think is that people cannot do without stories. I think that we understand our lives and we understand what has happened to us by virtue of the stories we tell, and I think kids tell each other stories so that they can prepare themselves for what they think they're about to go into. I think that's why stories are sometimes more important to kids than they are to adults. And I think that stories may arrive in different forms, platforms, people like to say now.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that, I just think that there will always be a preservationist impulse among a lot of people who love this stuff and who don't want to give it up. I mean, they may become the monks of the next few centuries who want to preserve this glorious, this precious heritage that we have from the Greeks all the way up to now. I just don't think that humanity is going to throw all of that away. I just don't think that'll happen. You know, the whole planet is going to burn at some point in the future. You know, we'll all be dust. But as long as people have stories to tell, they're going to want to preserve the stories from the past. I believe that.
Mm. Well, I think that's a beautiful place to end. And I completely agree.
Good.
Charles Baxter, thank you so much for joining me today on the History of Literature podcast.
Well, thank you. It was great.
Okay. Wasn't that excellent? I truly enjoyed that. It sent me back to Chekhov, too. Gusev is so good. I'd forgotten just how good that story is. And guess what? If you go now to audibletrial.com/HOL, you can get a free version of Chekhov's stories, read by Stephen Fry. Wow. It's a great combination. Why? Fry has a little sadness to him. A little streak of fun and good humor and merriment. And a little splash of melancholy. Just like Chekhov. He's an inspired choice. And he's not the only one. Kenneth Branagh reads a collection of Chekhov stories as well. It's another excellent pairing. And Michael Redgrave, several other options as well. The plays, too, for those of you who love theater. You can roam around the site at Audible, listening to samples, before you choose which one to pick as your free audiobook download, compliments of Audible and the History of Literature podcast. Saul Bellow's on there, too. I recommend Herzog, or my personal favorite, Humboldt's Gift. Or maybe you want to catch up on Paula Fox while you're driving or working out or trying to fall asleep. Well, there she is. And the works of Charles Baxter. The Feast of Love is there, and others as well. For short stories, there's a collection, There's Something I Want You to Do. That's audibletrial.com/HOL. A free book, a free 30-day trial membership, and you can cancel at any time. See what you think. Support the show and take advantage of Audible's generous offer to our listeners. My thanks today to Charles Baxter for stopping by. We'll be back soon with an episode devoted to Dorothy Parker, which is already in the works. Mike Palindrome joins us for that one. And a special Halloween episode that looks at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Oh, boy. For that episode, we'll be joined by our special guest, Professor James Chandler of the University of Chicago, who will tell us all about the text and the films it inspired.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Oh, don't you miss Gene Wilder? I certainly do. Rest in peace. I'm Jack Wilson. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.